You're saying about student demonstration again?
Yeah. Over the years, there have been a lot of student demonstrations for various reasons. Some of them had turned quite violent in the early days. A lot of them were centered around CUDA activists in the university. Mm-hmm. CUDA had cells in engineering and in medicine, particularly, I remember. In later years, it took different student violent student demonstrations arose for different reasons, but they've all always been sooner or later, mostly sooner, suppressed without any long range implication, long range threat. And the campus went back to being fairly quiet until the next excuse came along for a demonstration. Of course, there was a lot of resentment, I think, aroused from the fact that SARAC did, they had an office just off the campus to the north. And if you listened to some of the students, Santa's were 50% of them were SARAC informers. I don't think they were. Certainly SARAC had informers in the students like they had among everybody else. But I suspect a relatively small
Did CIA itself have sources among the students, just like you had sources that had contact with the clergy or with others? Did you gather information directly from students?
Not after about 1954 or so. Not that I'm aware of. And even in the early days, it was aimed at a Tudor party activity.
Let me ask you this. Would it ever happen that CIA would go to Sabah and say that we've been getting information, or we've come to the conclusion that you have a serious problem with your students and you better defuse it?
I never knew that to happen. Now, I think, as I suggested earlier, SADC was not very forthcoming with information that they didn't want us to have, for example, or that they thought was none of our business.
What nature of information would that be? Anything that reflected on the Shah, or?
Well, certainly anything that would reflect on the Shah, but then you didn't have to collect that kind of thing clandestinely anyhow. You go to any cocktail party and you'd spend half of the evening listening to some Iranians complaining about the Shah. I don't know, it's a little hard to say for sure, because I just don't remember ever. I don't really remember the particular situation arising.
Now, the confrontation with the students and guerrillas sort of dipped Sabah's hands into greater repression and torture. Did this become a concern at CIA? Was it raised with Sabah at any point?
Well, of course, SARAC, I think you could say that they were pretty successful in neutralizing
the guerrillas.
Mm-hmm. Where it broke down was when they started facing the mass movements that simply overwhelmed the assets that they had available, just as it did. The same thing happened in the military, in the army, of course. And that was guerrilla activity, certainly played a part in testing and in a sense weakening the state apparatus. But by itself, I think wouldn't have won the day. What overwhelmed South Africa, what overwhelmed the army, was simply the number, the masses, that the religious leadership was able to bring to the streets. And that, plus the fact that no matter over from what happened, if you look at what happened in Jolly Square, for example, the troops withdrew two or three times from confrontation there before they were finally, in a sense, backed into a corner and opened fire. But from the reporting that we had, the crowds were attempting, or at least crowd leaders were attempting to provoke a confrontation. And two or three times, the troops under orders had backed away to try to avoid it. As I say, they're finally backed into a corner and open fire.
This is based on your own sources or reports of?
No, this was based on information that was coming in at the time. There's also, of course, the story was spread that these weren't Iranian troops, these were Israelis and Iranian. I understand that a great many of them were Azerbaijani-speaking troops. I don't know how widespread the knowledge of Azerbaijani Turkish is among the the masses in Tehran. I know there are a lot of Azerbaijanis there, but somebody, I don't know who it was, speculating, maybe heard the troops talking to each other in Azerbaijani and just assumed, since it wasn't Persian, it's got to be Israel, it's got to be Hebrew. That was a sure speculation. But the story was spread that they were Israeli troops. Of course, they weren't, but still good. It's a good story to propagate in a situation like that.
With these students, there was also a big element of them in the United States at that time, in the form of the Confederation of Iranian Students.
Yeah.
Did their CIA or FBI try to monitor, learn about them, since it was on U.S. territory?
That would have been the FBI's job. I don't know to what extent they did monitor. I suspect they probably tried to monitor them to some extent.
But what about CIA? Would have your office been interested in their literature, in their publications, and seeing what they say, what they're up to?
Yeah. From an intelligence point of view, not an operational point of view. Yeah, we would have been interested. We were interested in their activities in Europe because it was it was in Europe, it was outside the U.S. We didn't get all that much information from the FBI, at least I didn't see it. All we did was kind of summaries of meetings or that kind of thing, but so far as CIA was concerned, that was not a domestic problem left up to the...
Was Savak et al. Ever interested in CIA performing this function of monitoring...
No, I remember even as early as once when I was there one of the, well, General Movaran asked me one time what information we could gather on what the students were doing in the United States. And I said I didn't have that information, but you know, I passed on the request because of my job too. And the answer that came back from headquarters was simply that we cannot pass on to SAVAK the activities of Iranian students in the United States who are not breaking the American law. Mm-hmm. And that was it. We gave no information because I had no information to give them. And I do not know that that was made, that request was made at another time to another officer, and with the same results. It was simply something we could not pass on because the students here were not doing anything illegal.
But the extent and zeal of the activities, did it arise any concerns with CIA, just observing how zealous they were about their business? Did it lead you to any conclusions regarding political stability in Iran and the future of the regime?
No, I don't think so.
And then,
somebody made the comment that was ironical, that there were more student converts to Marxism in the United States than in the rest of the world.
But in the 60s, during the time of President Kennedy, at least they were approached, the students were approached by Attorney General at that time, Robert Kennedy.
I understand that students went to Robert Kennedy with some of the complaints, and he listened sympathetically and probably passed it on to the president. But I don't know that anything ever came from that. That, after all, you know, Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General, and sometimes they might approach these things rather freely. He was still the Attorney General and bound by U.S. law and custom in problems like this.
Now, what were your impressions of SAVAK in the 70s, of the later SAVAK and those who ran it? Say, for instance, of Soviety, of Nasiri, of how it operated.
Well, I think generally we were concerned about Nasiri's overall approach, which was that of a policeman rather than an intelligence officer. And I think I alluded to this earlier. You know, not only are police officers looking for information that will lead to prosecution, an intelligence officer is looking for information that will lead to another step, to another contact, to information that will enable you to intercept a hostile line of communication, for example. Strictly speaking, an intelligence officer is not interested in prosecution, because as soon as prosecution occurs, that insight, that potential lead that you have in a hostile intelligence organization is gone. A policeman looks for a case to prosecute. An intelligence officer would rather avoid that, because as soon as you prosecute somebody, you've lost a potential window into the hostile organization.
Was there an attempt to correct this itself?
What does that mean?
You said there was concerns with this, but was there ever any attempts to correct it?
We're not in a position to correct it.
Any suggestions? Were suggestions given? Advice? Friendly advice? Or
I don't know. I suppose it might have. But see, by this time, the contact with the liaison with Cervantes on a very high level. We no longer have the low level contacts that we had in the early days. When you could, you know, when I could talk to an operations officer, almost on a one on one, kind of on a personal basis. We had offices in SADC, but we could visit almost any other, almost any other guy we knew in his own office. They could come to our office if they wanted to. And it was more of a collegial approach. But later on, you know, after the early 1960s, certainly by the late 60s, the Shah SADC under instruction from the Shah started drawing back from this very close relationship. This was not surprising. It didn't surprise us. Because our family became a professional organization. And professionally, any other intelligence service is, if not hostile, but not close friends.
What are your impressions of Sabit? Did you know him?
I did not know him well at all. As I recollect, when he came into SADC, he came into Department 3 first. Captain Zamani headed the two-party operations in Department 3. And I understood from a couple other people who worked under Zamani that Zamani was very worried that Sabeti was being sent over there to take over his job. I don't know.
Sabeti was a regular recruit from university. I mean,
I'm not sure.
Background.
That was my impression, but I'm just not sure.
Go ahead. Yes.
I never had a great deal of background information on Sabeti. The fact that Zamani was afraid that he'd come in to take over suggested to me that Sabeti must have had some important sponsorship. Zamani wouldn't have been that humbled about it. But Sabeti didn't stay there very long. Or maybe I didn't stay there much after that. That may have been toward, kind of late in my second tour.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Sabeti stayed in Department 3 very long. He moved on to something higher. I heard it was at the high. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Anyhow, no, I never knew him personally. I had no personal reaction to him at all.
He gained fame with the Taymur Bakhtiar episode in Iraq of Bakhtiar's images.
Yeah.
Was CIA independently aware of Bakhtiar's activities?
Not that I know. We sort of generally picked up information of where he was and very little on what he was doing specifically. I don't believe anybody maintained any contact with him after he left Iran. Somebody might have dropped in to see him in Switzerland on a personal basis, but I don't know that.
He didn't take it seriously that he was trying to.
I think there was some interest and surprise, but again, I think he wasn't seen as a direct threat. One reason being that the Shah had demonstrated over the years his ability to control and to monitor, control, and to counter opposition from all kinds of things. A little bit like Mossadegh when he was in power until 1953, almost every plot that had been made against Mossadegh, he found out about and was able to counter it.
That brings us to something I guess interesting that's been referred to on and off, and that the CIA had developed or had worked on psychological profiles of the Shah. Was this done routinely or?
Yes, done routinely on important.
What were the conclusions? I mean, how was he seen then?
Well, first of all, you're aware of the Jack Anderson article? That's all phony. Except for the first paragraph that says that there was a top secret psychological profile of the Shah. That's true. Everything else that he said, I recall, in there was in the actual profile.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember all the details in this. You know, it's a rather maybe a dozen pages, something like that. It was an examination of things that went into influencing his character. The kind of thing you would expect psychologists to do. It was done by a psychiatrist, and not by the analyst. So I worked very closely with the doctor that did it. We'll talk about it, family influences, the influence as far as we can tell his father or his family. In his early days, he was pretty henpecked by his mother and by Princess Asha.
What do you mean henpecked?
Henpecked. Maybe that's a colloquialism that you haven't run into.
No, I haven't.
To go wash a flock of chickens,
mm-hmm.
to establish their pecking order, their dominance, or subordination, by pecking each other's head. And this has become a colloquialism. A man or a husband who's henpecked is somebody who is criticized, controlled, or whose wife or girlfriend or whatever puts him in his place. So this was he was seen as in a sense subordinate to the criticism of the Queen Mother. He always compared him with Reza Shah, and he didn't, in her mind, he didn't match. He was anything like Reza Shah. Again, according to the reporting, the Princess Asha, who's a very strong character, tended to criticize him because he was not strong enough.
Even after he was Shah, and
even after he was Shah, especially after he was Shah. But whatever stories you hear about Asha, she was a strong character, and I think she had a good sense of what she wanted, what she thought was good for the Shah. Right or wrong, she rarely chilly-shied, she vacillated.
So the reports that the CIA believed that she would have aspirations for ruling Iran.
She would have what?
She could have aspirations for ruling Iran had the Shah passed away. That she was seen as a serious contender. Is that true?
I don't believe so, no. certainly she was worthy of respect in her own right. Although, as I say, a lot of the stories you heard about her reflected the other way, but, you know, strictly speaking, as a strong character she was. I don't remember anything that suggested that she had any aspirations. Although, at least in the early days, she might have made a better Shah than the Shah did.
But the gist of this report, which was mentioned early on, was that had the Shah died in office, that then she might have, with the help of military men, made a bid for power. That this was one of the scenarios that CIA thought feasible.
I don't know of anything to suggest it. And that the agency thought it was feasible. It might have been something that's kicked her out at one time or another. But, you know, as long as you had, Farah there.
Before the revolution happened, what did the CIA think would be possible scenario had the Shah died?
The most reasonable scenario would be,
without the benefit of hindsight, at that time.
Yeah, it would have been Farah acting as regent until Reza became of age. That seemed to be, that's what the arrangement was, technically. And at that point, nobody had any reason to think that it wouldn't move.
You wouldn't think that there would be enough of a power vacuum to invite the military anymore?
Not at that point, no. I think the feeling was that in the interest of maintaining stability, that the military would go along with this. I don't remember on the Regency Council right at this point, but the Regency Council was spelled out, and I think it included the Armed Forces Commander on the Regency Council.
Were you aware at this time in the 70s of the Shah's illness?
No.
Nobody did.
One reason being that over the years, we piled ahead, as if not every year or every other year, somebody would report that the Shah was suffering from some dread disease, you know, he was having a mental breakdown, or he had syphilis and was dying, even goes in the medical dictionary. And one time or another, the Shah was reported as suffering from something or other. So even at one time, he was reported suffering from cancer. So unless we had had an extremely reliable report, it would have gone in the file along with everything else. You see, the Shah routinely had medical examinations out at Bethesda, at the hospital at Bethesda. And he was always in good health, but
that must have ceased at some point. That those checkups must have ceased at some point.
It did cease at some point. I suspect it might have. This is a speculation on my part, but these examinations might have stopped or been stopped by the Shah because he thought, for whatever reason, that he had something serious. And he was afraid, if it came to the attention of the United States, that he was seriously ill, that then the U.S. would start looking for somebody else that they would have to support. Mm-hmm. And apparently, although they had French doctors, we had no indication that the French intelligence knew this either. Mm-hmm. And in spite of the stories that get spread around, the Israelis. The, you know, there's a story going around that all the Israelis knew it and had told the U.S. and we'd ignored it. We went through the files at the time we heard that story. There was no indication in the information that papers that we could find that the Israelis had ever planned this story, had ever passed the story on to anybody.
There generally is stories about Israel's with perspicacity regarding the revolution, their foreknowledge of revolution and their superior knowledge of events in Iran. And
they had a good knowledge of events in Iran.
Did they have a significant intelligence gathering?
Yeah, I think they probably had a larger presence than we were aware of, because just I'm sure every other country, you know, Britain, France, maybe even Pakistan, whatever, had a larger presence than we were aware of, because you never had a complete knowledge of what another country is doing intelligence-wise. But they, you know, they had a lot of good people. I assume they were good people. Iranian Jews who had immigrated to the to Israel, and they could send them back, infiltrate them one way or the other, and it'd be practically indistinguishable from the average Iranian, because in everything except for allegiance, they were Iranian. They'd been born and raised in the Iranian milieu. So, you know, at least for that, but. It seems to me that if they had really been convinced that the Shah was going, that they would not have been caught with so many Israelis in Tehran, with such a large installation still in place. It doesn't make sense that they would have risked so much. If they were convinced that the Shah was going, they would have gone down their embassy. They would have closed out some of the operations just for safety's sake.
We didn't finish our discussion of the Shah's psychological.
Oh yeah,
that what was the conclusions of how did the CIA read it in the end?
Yeah, in a nutshell, and without being able to quote it exactly, since I haven't seen it for a dozen years. But while, now keep in mind, this was done 77 or 78, maybe 77, perhaps. That while the Shah was under significant stress politically and perhaps individually, there were stories about he was having troubles with, marital troubles with her and so on. That at that point he seemed to be handling all the stress well, and no reason to think that he couldn't continue to handle the situation well. That was about the upshot of it.
Well, why was the profile commissioned at that point in time? Or was this done periodically?
No, it wasn't done periodically by for the Shah, but it was often done on significant foreign leaders, especially if they were in a sensitive country and under some stress. I mean, you know, one had been done on Sukarno previously, one we've been done on Nasser.
Did the psychological report indicate that the Shah would not act if pressure was mounted on him?
I don't recall if it did.
I remember hearing this on television, that somebody who allegedly had a hand in preparing the report said that he I told CIA that the Shah was a megalomaniac and things of that nature.
I think the Shah was not a megalomaniac. At least not, you know, so this was a term that was used in the Jack Anderson report.
But I don't know. That was the upshot of the report.
But I don't recall that was used at all in the report.
So how did the report, what sort of a character did the report see the Shah as? If you would put it shortly, I mean, what sort of a person did you come across in that report?
I think it came across as a strong personality who was capable of handling whatever pressures he might face in a rational manner, that he was given, as his father had been before, to use force rather than force against his opponents if it became necessary. Not only an ability, but a willingness to do that. I think, you know, in reviewing the early influences, as I just suggested, there's some stuff about his relationship with his father, relationship with his family, kind of traced what seemed to be his development from a more or less unsure, a ruler who was unsure of what he could do and what he couldn't do. There's been a lot of indication of what he wanted to do, early indications that he wanted to play the same kind of role that his father had done, but also that he, in spite of what he wanted to do, he was tended to vacillate, unsure that he could really do it. It traced sort of his the way in which his approach, or like his personality, had changed as he saw things going his way, as he saw, at least in his own mind, some of the successes that he was having, some of the advancement that Iran was making under his guidance. After all, you know, if you look at Iran from the 30 years from 1941 to 1971, there was a very big difference. A lot of changes have been made, a lot of them, at least from Western point of view, for the good, for the better. Ran into a lot of problems that he had handled. I think the key thing that was not in that profile, because we didn't know about it, was the fact that he had cancer, and the second, that he was being treated for. In talking to some of the agency doctors later, after this became clear, they pointed out that the medication that he was taking caused very strong mood swings, strong personality changes. I talked to a friend of mine, now retired, who was an Arab states specialist. His wife had died of cancer, and she had been taking a very similar drug. And I talked to him about this, and he said, yes, indeed, his wife, when she was taking this drug, did have a very, very strong reaction to it, and her personality, her changes in her mood. I think we've been aware of this, and the fact that it into the equation. It probably would have come to considerably, at least cast some doubt on the fact that the Shah would be able to maintain the strong and decisive actions he had before. At the time of 1978, late 78, either the American ambassador or the British ambassador was seeing the Shah about every other day, constantly talking to him. One day, you would get the ambassador would report that the Shah was very upbeat, alert, right on top of the problems. Next day, 2 days later, he would be depressed, being unable to make any kind of a decision, throwing up his hand, not knowing what to do. Again, when we were getting these reports from the British and American ambassadors, we didn't know that the Shah was under this medication. But these mood swings, changes from one day to the next, fitted in very nicely with the response, the physiological response that was produced by the anti-cancer drug that he was taking.
Another issue comes to mind, let me ask about this. It appears that sometimes, or at least the Iranians allege, that sometime in the 60s, there were certain rivalries between the British and the Americans in Iran. It came out in the form of a book, first, that Ismail Rahim wrote about Freemasonry in Iran, and with a picture of Mr. Sharif Amami in the full regalia of Masonry, and it was charged that this was Rahim was put to this by CIA to sort of debase the British boys. And then the British came out with a book, allegedly with a list of America's golden boys in Iran.
I'm aware of Ryan's book. I don't know that was the product of any rivalry at all. I'm sure from time to time, I mean, you can get it, you know, if you read the Foreign Office dispatches and then read the ones that are available now, and read State Department stuff, you can trace a history of disagreements, arguments over this approach or that approach and so on. But I seriously doubt that led to anything like that.
But of course, you have the Suez Canal it's a sort of echo of the whole Suez Canal scenario. Suez crisis that U.S. replaced the great European great powers as the supreme foreign presence in the region.
I'm not trying to be flippant or insulting, but I think you could write a fun book about Iranian mythology in foreign affairs. I don't understand where it comes from or how it arises. But in Iranian society, there is a great capacity to see intrigue where there's only confusion. Ryan's book was kind of interesting, but history of Freemasonry in Iran is kind of interesting too, in more or less in a non-intelligence sense, except I suspect that the British did use it for intelligence purposes.
The Masonry.
Yeah.
In other words, it had contacts with the British and it did provide them with sources within the government.
I assume this is true. I have no specific information on this. This would have been a British clandestine operation that they would not have shared with us. But it makes perfectly good sense. Several articles have been written on it. How good the articles are, I don't know. I remember we even made a study. The Freemasons were active in Egypt, active in Turkey. I believe there's an allegation that Al-Afghani was an AC.
Alexander,
yeah. So, you know, the specific question that you had, that this was an outgrowth of, or a product of desperate rivalry between the British and Americans.
But generally, did the agency have, the years 65 to at beginning outset of the revolution were a period of smooth sailing with the government in Iran. I mean, you didn't have Mossad there with Amin, Raz Marab. So the attention was, how much of the attention was focused on opposition?
Not much.
No. So you were mainly concerned with issues such as oil policy and military policy and...
Again, reverting for to what I talked about earlier, might be worth clarifying. Information is collected against requirements that have been laid on by most of our policymakers. You have an intelligence agency has a limited budget and unlimited personnel. When you look at the whole world, everything you might collect, looking specifically at Iran in the 60s and the 70s, for budgetary reasons, and because there was no immediate threat perceived, budgets were reduced, personnel were set elsewhere where there were more important things going on. So without the perception of a threat, Iran got sort of a cursory treatment. Because if you look at the world as a whole, there are a lot more important things going on.
Exactly.
So if you have three or four high priority things, you're going to aim your assets at collecting against those targets. You move down to second and third and fourth priority,